Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, actress and writer Annabelle Gurwitch discusses her new book, The End of My Life is Killing Me, The Unexpected Joys of a Cancer Slacker, with comedian Chelsea Hood. This program was part of the 2026 American Writers Festival. Co-hosted by the American Writers Museum and the Chicago Public Library, the American Writers Festival is a free literary event featuring in-depth conversations with diverse writers from across genres and backgrounds. This conversation took place June 7th, 2026, and was recorded live at the Harold Washington Library Center. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Hello, and welcome to the first program in this space at the American Writers Festival. My name is Annie Allman, and I'm the Administrative Associate at the American Writers Museum. I'm excited to introduce our first program of the day. Annabelle Gurwitch is an actress, activist, and New York Times bestselling author of 6 books and 2-time finalist for the Thurber Prize for American Humor Writing. Her writing appears in the New York Times, Washington Post, New Yorker, Washington Street Journal, among other publications. She hosted Dinner and a Movie on TBS, appeared in too many shows and movies, including Seinfeld, Dexter, Better Things, Daddy Daycare, and was a regular commentator on NPR. Chelsea Hood is a stand-up comedian living in Chicago, Illinois, by way of the comedy scenes in both Dallas, Texas, and Brooklyn, New York. You may have seen her on WGN, the CW Network's Eye Opener, or CW33's Nightcap. Please welcome them to the stage for a discussion of Annabelle's extraordinary memoir, The End of My Life is Killing Me.
Thank you. Chelsea and I just noticed that we both have on sensible loafers, so we're forming a comedy group, two gals with sensible loafers.
And we're looking for a suggestion from the audience. Thank you so much for spending your time with us here today. I'm so excited to meet you and to chat about this book. I was just talking about it upstairs and started crying because I loved it so much, so we'll try to hold that together for the next hour. I just want to talk so much about all of it. There's a lot of, I'm a theater kid. I was, you know, thespian of the year, so I got really lost in this love letter to great storytelling, and I think this is just such a great collection of stories, of moments, and I wonder kind of what made you choose these specific stories, these moments, and what you were trying to showcase in each one.
You know, as every writer has like an agenda with a book that's not the stated agenda, the goal for this book was to write a satire of Emily's goodbye scene in Our Town. That was my secret goal. I really loved Ann Patchett's novel, Tom Lake. Did anyone read that? About being a once and forever Emily. And so my miniature goal was to find a way to get to write a satire of that. But the goal of this book was to look at how trauma affects the brain and to look at frameworks of thinking that could provide joy in life in the face of existential dread. This is been the topic that I've been living and thinking about for 5 years since I was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer during COVID. And I've been so fortunate enough to not have what people typically call a cancer journey. And I hate the word journey because they've taken this great word, adventure, travel, and put it with cancer. So I've decided we should just call it, and I think it should be officially called, cancer bullshit. Like when you go see the oncologist, they should say, okay, here's how we're going to deal with your cancer bullshit. Because they actually write now, they say your cancer journey. And that's just unfair. Don't take a word I love. But I've been so lucky to be on this targeted therapy where I've had these 5 years of stability physically. So the issue for me that this diagnosis, which came out of the blue, has brought up was how do I deal with this emotionally? As I describe in the book, getting this diagnosis was like, and there's this great word that I learned about, and I love a word, Emilio Ungara, the Mexican philosopher, had coined this phrase, zozobra, which translates to mean shipwreck, but he uses this word as shipwreck of the soul. When I read that, I was like, oh my God, I had a shipwreck of the soul. Of course, then I had another shipwreck of the soul when Trump was elected, and then elected again, and then everything he does every day, and you open the newspaper, and it's another shipwreck of the soul. Like this, I felt like this topic was not only for so pressing for people going through, like, what kind of traumas there were. The fires in Los Angeles, there's all, just everything we're living through right now in this country, the reversal of our values, it just all seemed like, oh, this is a time to write about how we find coping mechanisms. How do we find joys in the face of these traumas that we live, that we're living through? So this is the goal of the book. And then in the structure of the book, as you'll see, each chapter is a story about some other kind of framework of thinking that I try, some successful, others less successful, in trying to find daily or everyday joys. So that was my goal. And in that goal was also to work in Greek mythology, to work in our town, to work in Samuel Beckett, to work in so many things that I find inspiring, because I'm certainly not the first person who has asked this question, which I thought was so amazingly articulated by Samuel Beckett in Text for Nothing, which is a collection of his stories, which starts with the two sentences, "I can't go on, I'll go on." Those sentences were the real, you know, guiding light of this book. When I first read that and saw that actually as a play when I was 18, I thought, oh, this is hyperbole. This is existentialism. This is like drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes in a cafe in Paris. I can't go on, I'll go on. And then I woke up at 60 after this diagnosis and thought, I can't go on, I'll go on. I am living this. And what is the space between those two sentences? How do you get from I can't go on to I'll go on? And that is the longest answer I'm going to give, I promise.
That was one of the first things I wrote down when I was kind of going through the book for the second time of how I'm going to moderate this. And I wrote down, when you relate to Samuel Beckett, you know you're in dire straits. And I was like, oh, girl, preach, preach. I really love that. And I think, for someone, you know, I'm not a diagnosed patient, but I have had so many girlfriends go through breast cancer in the last couple of years. I've had so many friends go through all kinds of things, and I think we struggle. Oh, man, I did send a robe. I sent a robe.
Did you send a juicer?
I didn't send a juicer.
Because that's the juicer is the Waterford crystal bowl of the cancer, of the recently diagnosed. Can I just say, when I first wrote about being diagnosed with cancer in the New York Times, I was a little worried because it was during COVID, and I hadn't connected with other people who'd had this experience. I was worried that other people might be upset if I said something about, you know, I know everyone has the best intentions when they send a juicer, but I felt like I was being sentenced to a juicer, like, now you're going to have to juice. Like, you don't just have cancer, you have to make juice every day. Like, I didn't make juice before I had cancer, now I have to make juice. And so when I was making fun of that in the Times, I thought, oh, I hope I don't upset someone. But I don't think they saved these, but at the time, in the comments, people thanked me, and they added pictures of their abandoned juicers. I just love those. Those made me feel so much. That was my first sense of community, that people could have a sense of the absurdity, and that I could still have a sense of humor, because I didn't want cancer to take a sense of humor from me.
that was my identity, and I felt that was being threatened.
Well, I've been a stand-up comedian for 15 years, and we're quite comedy snobs, and I laughed out loud multiple times. So I will say that you have not lost your sense of humor.
Two gals wearing sensible loafers laughing out loud about cancer.
That's
going to be our second show,
that's comedy. The musical version. We're doing a lot of yes and. But I will say that as a person who sent the robe, not the juicer, I find it's hard to determine, like, am I doing enough? Am I checking in too much? Am I not? I don't know how to support you, which is not your burden. But one of the things that I loved was...
Oh, but it is.
I know, and we do turn it on to y'all. Checking in again, hadn't heard back from you. You're, like, still dying, thanks. You know, like, people are like, stop texting. But I loved the concept of a cancer slacker. Just that sort of undertone throughout, and I kind of want you to elaborate on that and tell us more of like what that means to you.
Well, I'm so glad you asked, Chelsea. And let me just say, right before we started, I said to Chelsea, would you ask me about being a cancer slacker? So it's a little bit of a setup here.
We tried to do it cash.
We did. But you know, I'm definitely like I'm that person who has to, you know, tell you the construct behind the construct. So I said to Chelsea, ask me about that, because at every event I've done, I've gotten a lot of questions about this cancer slacker idea. And I feel like it's actually what has happened is my readers have made me even think more deeply about what did I mean when I wrote the term cancer slacker. So my idea for this cancer slacker, and by the way, if you want to join my cancer slacker club, the great thing is, being a slacker, we have no requirements. All you have to do is just declare yourself a cancer slacker. The idea of being a cancer slacker occurred to me when I was diagnosed, like so many people. People, my friends, my family, people I didn't know when I came forward in the New York Times with this diagnosis, started calling me brave, telling me I was a warrior, a cancer warrior, and I was going to fight this. And I just didn't feel like a warrior. And I started to feel like an imposter syndrome. Every time someone would say I was a cancer warrior, I felt worse about myself. Because if I wasn't having a day when I felt brave and like fighting, I felt like a fraud. And I thought, we have to have a kinder, gentler kind of language. And I was very close with the writer Barbara Ehrenreich. Are any of you fans of her work? You know, she wrote Nickel and Dimed, and she also wrote some amazing books that I highly recommend. It's like a pair, my books and her books, I hope. Her book, Bright-Sided, about the negative side of positive thinking. After I was diagnosed, Barbara wrote me an email and she said, oh my goodness, why aren't we talking? The best way to deal with this, as I found, is to bitch and moan as much as possible. And I loved that because it was like a permission to be human. And so I thought, oh, the cancer idea, cancer slacker idea, first of all, it was also a comedy idea, cancer warrior, cancer slacker, was first this idea of having a kinder, gentler lexicon. And then I realized it had a whole other, more serious implication. So when I started on this treatment, I started on this targeted therapy at the level that it was prescribed at. And it was, I had such profound toxicities that it's supposed to, these targeted therapies, what they do is they turn off one gene. Is anyone on a targeted therapy, just by the way? So some of you know this. Not to make you identify as like, hey, I have cancer. But this turns off one gene in your body, which is, the idea is that it's a much gentler kind of treatment than chemo or radiation, and it can be very effective for a certain amount of time, after which it stops working. But while it's working, the idea is that the side effects are manageable. When I started on this drug, I was having, maybe I had 7 hours
of awake time during the day, which unfortunately were not consecutive.
I was falling asleep. There was one day I was on a walk run from my house. I was maybe two blocks away when I write in the book, I crumpled like a wet potato chip. I just had to lay down on the side of the road, on the sidewalk. I just couldn't go any further. I was having all kinds of gastric side effects. It was just so terrible. For the first 3 months, I thought, is this living? I can't survive this treatment. But I didn't tell my doctor because I was a cancer warrior. I was battling. I was fighting. And when I finally said, I can't survive this treatment, I learned that I could get on a lower dosage. We halved my dosage. And I have been on that half dosage with the same effectiveness for 5 years. And so this idea of a cancer warrior was not only something that was funny and that was also like kinder and gentler in an emotional sense, but it actually has real life consequences. And so the idea of a cancer slacker is also to posit the idea to oncologists and the medical establishment that when we are called a cancer warrior, which also doctors will say, you're going to fight this, you're so brave. I mean, this is an accepted language, which is meant to be helpful, but it can also be limiting and can really affect people's lives. So I'm pushing against that. I had thought about calling this book, against something like one of Susan Sontag's book, but apparently, according to my publisher and agents, people don't think about Susan Sontag as much as I do, which makes me really sad. Or they don't think about me in the context of Susan Sontag, which had been my dream. But that's another one of those expectations versus realities that a comedian can deal with. So there's a serious implication to the cancer slacker that I invite you to contemplate, should you or someone you love be in treatment, or if you are a doctor, to think about how a label and how words can affect our actual behavior. So that's my cancer slacker speech.
I love that. I felt like there were so many times where I'm not a stranger to grief or trauma. Again, I'm a comedian, so we live in that. But there was just a lot of human moments that I felt like you were very comfortable just like taking the entire curtain off. It was like, look, I'm going to just like leave this very like bare-boned and you're going to see all of it. And I think that was very transparent to me. And also just the fact that people going through treatment tend to hide things from the people that they love to protect them was really impactful for me. And I felt, oh man, leveled by guilt probably for not even thinking that that's of course happening.
That is definitely not, guilt is not the goal, but I enjoy it.
But yeah, good.
Is that wrong?
A little pain for us, great.
Fantastic. There is this other aspect that I wanted to write to, and I want to speak about that for just a minute, about this idea of how we support our support system. And this can be when you're going through anything. You know, it's funny, I mean, this book isn't a book about divorce, but I was going through a divorce at the same time as I got diagnosed. And I remember, this is not in the book, but I just remember when someone said to me, like, oh, how's your asshole, meaning my ex-husband? And I thought, what? Only I call him that, in secret and in private. And I, but this idea of like someone thinking they're supporting you by saying that. And it's so hard, and I think one of the things I'm writing to in this book is this idea of this conversation that we're in with people in our lives, whatever we're going through, of how we support people. This becomes a really big issue when you are, and I know I've been on the other side of it. I have sent robes too, never sent a juicer. But I know I've also said things that I know now are triggering. And so I wanted to address this in the book because this became a huge issue with my friends and my family and sort of the moment, there was a moment. So my first birthday while I was in treatment, I thought it would be really funny if I had on my cake, I had the words printed, "Not dead, just resting," which is a line that Elaine May, the comedian and writer Elaine May, wrote in the movie that was a terrible flop in Hollywood, Ishtar, which has a lot of really funny lines. So "Not dead, just resting." The cake comes out, and I think this is going to be hilarious. And my sister bursts into tears. And she says, "You know, Annabelle, you think it's funny, but it's hard for people who love you." And that was a wake-up call for me about how difficult it is for the people we love in our lives to see us going through something difficult. And that was when I began to reach out for other community support. And I thought I had such a strong support network, and I didn't need that. But in fact, I needed that because I needed to have people who weren't people in my life who were able to support me. And when you're going through something, and this is something I thought about in terms of my particular situation or the situation that we're all living through in our hostage situation at this time when democracy is so challenged in our country, how do you live through something in a long term? How do you live through something that does not have a distinct beginning, middle, and end, which is a very tidy story? I'm in a situation myself where the anticipation is lifelong treatment. So this is not something where we are like, we're going to gear up, we're going to watch funny cat videos for 3 months, and then you'll be done. Not that funny cat videos aren't great. I love a funny cat video. But how do I survive this long term? And that's when there's a story in the book about reaching out to what I call Angel HQ, Immerman's Angels, which just happens to be a local Chicago treasure, where they match you with someone who has the same diagnosis with you as you. And I got matched with my angel. Now, I thought, oh my God, angel, is this like a religious cult? I took me a year to reach out because I thought, I was afraid, oh, they're going to pray for me. Thoughts and prayers, prayer hands. Oh, it was terrifying. It didn't turn out to be that way at all. But that was the beginning of my getting involved in this community, which is very much like joining an improv company or a theater company or a book. You know, it just became such an important, what I would call, scaffolding in my life. And just by the way, in the end of the book is not a how-to or a prescriptive, and I always say, never do anything that someone who is a former actress said that they do, which I am. But in the end of the book, I do offer a guide of resources. And there's something I wrote about called the 3H system. Has anyone read the book and read about the 3H system? Do you want to hear about that for one moment? Okay. So the 3Hs are something my sister actually had researched and come up with. So it's a something you, when you're trying to support someone going through something difficult, you ask yourself the 3Hs before you start the conversation, where you tell them exactly what they should do, which is my instinct as well. You ask, or if you don't ask directly, you try to intuit from your conversation. Would you like to be heard, helped, or hugged? That was really transformational in my relationship with people who are really close to me. I shared that with them because sometimes when you're going through something really difficult, you don't want advice, even if it's the best advice in the world. So my sister and I started following this, and I wanted to offer that in the book as well because it's been so helpful. I will, and this goes beyond cancer, you know, this goes to anything. Do you want to be helped, heard, or hugged? Now, we've taken it to this ridiculous level because sometimes it can seem a little bit, you know, precious to ask that. I called her the other day. She was stuck in an elevator, and I said, would you like to be helped, heard, or hugged? So, I mean, we realize there are limitations to this, but it has been so helpful in sort of managing that guilt because sometimes I want to be hugged. Sometimes I want to be heard. Sometimes I want to be helped. Mostly, I want to just be heard when I'm talking to my sister. So it's been really helpful. And so I offer that in the end of the book as a little bit of how-tos.
I love that. Can we talk about, you talked just a minute ago about what made you choose the name, your title for your book. Can we talk about the chickadee on the front doing a leg lift?
Yes.
Thigh lift? I don't know what you would call it on a chickadee, but it's
does anyone dramatic. have the book with them? Because I want to hold that up. If yes, okay. So how everyone has asked me, how did I end up with this book cover? And there's a story behind this cover. So, yes, this is the book cover for a book called The End of My Life is Killing Me. Huh? So what happened was, in this book, as you'll see, I write about one of the things I looked to for inspiration and was what I call the It Girls of Greek mythology. You know, you can scroll through Instagram or you can go back to Ovid's Metamorphoses. Who ever thought that was the two choices in life? But that's what it came down to for me, because there's lots of Instagram and TikTok videos out there about how to live through hard times. And someone suggested Ovid's Metamorphoses. And for the first couple years after this diagnosis, I felt like I was a Persephone. Living, if you remember the myth of Persephone. Persephone has been seduced or raped by Hades. You know, really depends on whose translation you read. And she is stolen into the underworld, and her mother rescues her, and they make a deal. Persephone spends half of the year in the world of the living, half of her time in the underworld. And that's what I felt. I felt I was in between worlds. And as I started to be able to cope, and I tried these different coping mechanisms that you'll read about in the book, I began to feel more like I could engage in life again. And I started reading about Daphne. In the story of Daphne and Apollo, Daphne transforms into a laurel tree to escape the clutches of Apollo. And I became fascinated with Daphne because, as it turns out, in Metamorphosis, which is a book about metabolizing change, Daphne is the only character who exercises agency. She asks for transformation. And I began to feel like I needed to be a Daphne, someone who could accept the changes in my life, accept this new chapter in my life. And I found myself in Rome. I've become very involved in cancer advocacy, and I got an invitation to speak in Rome. I had given a talk, and afterwards, a doctor had said, you know, you must come to Rome and speak to our group. And I said, well, yes, I must. Yes, I must do that. Absolutely. And so I was in Rome, and I found myself standing in front of Bernini, the sculptor Bernini's Apollo and Daphne, which I like to think of as Daphne and Apollo, because who's really the hero in this story? And this image of Daphne transforming into a laurel tree, this was going to be my book cover. So I email a picture of the statue to my publishers. They're just not crazy about this. So then I said, okay, how about this? Because there's a story in the book which I lived, which is I went to Europe on a low-rent van tour with a heavy metal band and worked as their merch girl at 60. This was what I thought was going to be a bucket list trip, which I didn't realize involved
a low rent van tour with four 27-year-olds riding on the hump, which I learned was called riding bitch. So I said, okay, how about Daphne has a lanyard around her neck, like for this, you know, backstage pass at a concert of a heavy metal band. I tried all these pictures of Daphne for months. I was sending, there's a painting of Daphne transforming into a laurel tree. So I get an email in November of last year saying, we've got your book cover. It's not what you expected. I open it. It's a chicken doing yoga. I burst into tears and I was like, a chicken doing yoga? What, do these people hate me? What has happened to me? And I called my friend Nina, and she said, I don't know, Annabelle. It's just funny. I don't know why, but the chicken doing yoga is funny. I think you should think about this. And then I called my son, and he said, is this book about chicken? I said, no. He said, okay. Do you think that chicken should be wearing pants? I said, okay, that's creepy. I hadn't thought about how overexposed that chicken might be. And I was standing there, and I happened to be at a conference in Spain. And so I had about three more glasses of wine, more than the first one I had had when I got this cover. And I wrote them back, I love it. It's perfect, because it was the exact opposite of what I felt, and that was one of the things I was trying out at that point in my life. Just say yes, no matter what, even when you want to say no. And the funny thing is, it took another maybe 3 months and other glasses of wine before I realized, oh my God, they had actually tapped into the theme of this book, which is you want Baroque art and life gives you a chicken doing yoga. This is what the book is about, the absurdity of your expectations versus what life gives you. And so I ended up with the perfect book cover. But every time I look at it, and people have said to me, oh my God, I bought your book because there's a chicken doing yoga or a chick doing a stretch or whatever, or because it's not wearing pants, or because maybe it's about chicken. It's just so funny to me. It gives me such a laugh because I just think this is the lesson in and of itself, is the ridiculous book cover. So...
hilarious. Yeah, it does not give us what we want, does it? We're going to take some time to do some Q&A. I feel like there's a lot of people in here having, you know, shared experience to me where you have questions and you want them answered. So we'll open it up. If any of you have questions, we would love to kind of dive into that.
Jane Hamilton, whose latest book, The Phoebe Variations, I really love.
Thank you, Annabelle. Do you think that your publisher is as smart about the cover as you credit
I'm going to let that question linger. You know, that's a funny thing, right? As an author, as a writer, you think you know best. And I always look at each book as a collaboration. And you know, the funny thing is when you have a clash with an editor or a publisher, there's often something important in that message, you know, even in just the disagreement. There's one chapter in the book that I had a couple of editors because we had some changes in the infrastructure of the publisher, and one chapter became contentious. And the issue was, there's a chapter about I was looking to adopt kittens during COVID and after the diagnosis. And my editor was like, I don't think this chapter belongs in this book. I know you want to write about your cats. Like,
how am I going to fit my cats in a book about living with cancer? And I realized by arguing this point what it was, and I had to go back and make sure I really got this into the book, what I was doing in that chapter. And as you see, when you read the book, I'm trying to go from the... At first, when I was diagnosed, I tried the whole carpe diem, seize the day idea. And then I found out through the exhaustion and also through working as a merch girl for a heavy metal band, which was all that like, carpe diem, you can carpe too much diem. So I started to do smaller and smaller gestures. So in the book, I'm writing from these really big things I try to do, saying yes to everything, which is how I ended up snorting ketamine, doing a whole ketamine experiment. I do all these big things, and then I'm looking at the very smallest things I can do to find joy in my life and how this diagnosis and trauma was affecting my brain. So this story about trying to adopt kittens involves this decision I had to make, which was, it was really hard. Did anyone try to adopt a pet during COVID? People in California were driving to Wisconsin for puppies. It was really hard. The competition was rough. So I'm trying to get a cat rescuer to agree to let me adopt kittens. And she sends me a contract. And in the contract, I'm supposed to agree or disagree, and then I won't get the cats, that cats are family. I'm supposed to sign this, and I tell my friend Bart, I can't sign this contract because I love my cats, but cats aren't family. He's like, darling, that contract is not legally binding. Like, I know, but this is how the diagnosis was affecting my brain. I thought, what if this is the last contract I ever sign? And I have lied and said, cats are family. So I didn't get those cats because I couldn't sign the contract. Ironically, the contract also said that the cat rescuer would have unlimited visitation rights. That's the part that should have freaked me out. But no, I just didn't believe cats are family. And so this, I had to make sure when I had this disagreement with my editor, like that this, that I'd made that really clear that this was the point of the essay. How small an issue had come up that was affecting me because I was living with this diagnosis. And so this whole controversy about, you know, the book cover or whether or not I should write about Betty and Shirley, my beloved cats, who were other cats that I ended up getting, which I didn't have to say cats are family, but now I believe they are family. Oh, it's so complicated in the cat world. But these issues, when an editor brings it up, like I've learned now when I first started publishing, you know, 6 books ago, I would just be like, ugh, I know so much more than they do. Now I think they're doing me a favor. Maybe they're pointing out that there's something that I just need to make a little bit clearer in a story. And there was also no way I wasn't putting those cats in this book because they're so cute. But, you know, but so that again, is sort of like, do I think I know more my publisher? Well, yes, of course I do. But also, you know, it's, as it turns out, this was a teachable lesson for me to listen to other people. And just, God, if life doesn't just give you more teachable lessons all the time. It's so annoying. I hate that.
We all just keep growing.
Ugh.
You know?
This is an whenever someone says, this is a growth opportunity, I just want to punch them. Cancer can be an opportunity to learn something. Oh, no. Shut up. But, you know, as... This is the case.
You're a wealth of knowledge. I found that the things that you cover in the book are like
from over here to over here, and then also like where the best pastry is in Rome. You're like, okay, I'm listening.
And just by the way, if you're trying to adopt kittens and someone says to declare their family, just do it. That's ridiculous. Don't be like me. Are there other questions? Yes.
I'm interested in how the experience of writing all of these experiences you had changed the way you reflect on them, meaning you sort of compiled them as themes in your book. So I'm wondering if now looking back, you think that you fit them into the theme more than maybe you would have if you didn't write it, or if it's the other way, where you look back and you view those experiences as more complex than you're able to put in your writing.
Okay. Is this like the contract? I'm not quite, no. There's not, you know, a single answer to that, but I mean, I think about all of what does writing do for us, right? I'm writing, you know, for a couple of reasons, right? I'm always writing to work out my own relationship to something, and I hope that by the time that I'm publishing, I have thought it out entirely, you know. That said, I would like to rewrite almost every book I've written. You know what I mean? But I do feel like in this book, you know, and this is one of the reasons why I'm not writing a distinct narrative. I mean, there is a change. I mean, you'll see in the book there's a change from my initial attitude, the Carpe Diem, to going to an older translation of Carpe Diem, which is pluck the day, which was something I hadn't learned about until later on. So there's a journey in this book, which is different from bullshit, I hope. I stand by that. You know, I feel like I examined these ideas to an extent where I feel like I could publish. I think that is sort of a metric for me. Have I looked at every angle of something before I publish? And the funny thing is though, I'm living this story still, and I am continuing to publish on this subject. And it's funny you ask that, because I just published a piece in the New York Times in which I write a little bit more about something I wrote in the book that I didn't quite understand, which is I started a relationship, or what I've heard the term is situationship, with someone after this diagnosis. And in the book, I write about how I have what I prefer to say instead of love is fond. I am deeply fond of you. And I hadn't completely examined that idea when I wrote it in the book. And so I published a piece recently in the New York Times about what it means to fall deeply in fond as opposed to fall deeply in love. And I don't think I quite understood when I published this book, which when I finished the book, that I, as I write in the Times, I have lost the capacity to fall in love. That is something that I left behind after this diagnosis. And in this piece, though, I argue that falling in fond is a promotion as opposed to a demotion, because as with other things in my life, I am inventing a new way of living for myself. Falling in fond, retiring the falling in love, falling in fond, it has a freshness for me that allows me to have the kind of curiosity to continue a relationship, which is also happening at the same time as I have a relationship to my mortality that is very present all the time. So I have had to invent other ways of coping, and that includes a relationship. And that by inventing something new, a new relationship, I don't have the constraints of the old falling in love. And so I have a curiosity that makes me, in fact, a better partner in fond than I was in love. Does that make sense to you? So that was something I did realize I had not explored entirely in the book, and I think I was afraid to actually even really think about all the implications of that. And I've had more time now to think that through. By the way, I'm in a situationship with someone who has a good sense of humor. When I first said, "I am deeply fond of you," that was received with a, "Oh." And now he's sort of come around to this idea that that this is actually a really good thing. And so it's just sort of like the cancer slacker, the falling in fond idea. So that is one of the things I'm also writing to is in this book, I hope for you when you read it, is an invitation to curiosity about how you're living, because that is what I feel like keeps me going, a curiosity. If I just think every day about, oh, the drug I'm on is going to stop working any day now, that is the reality of the baseline that I live with. And I think, how am I going to do that? I don't know. How am I going to deal with that when that happens? But if I can be curious about that and say, well, that's going to be interesting because I really don't know. When you don't have answers, to lean into the curiosity of that as opposed to the terror of not having an answer. I don't know how I can be in a relationship while I'm going through this. So I gave it a different name, and I keep a curiosity about it. That's a much longer answer. I just want to say I'm given to long answers, and I apologize for that. I did a Fresh Air interview with Terry Gross recently, which was like a big life moment on NPR, you know, and at one point she said to me, "Annabelle, could you give me shorter answers?" And I said, "I'm so sorry, Terry Gross." I said her whole name. "I can't, okay, Terry Gross." I was like, oh my God, Terry Gross just told me I'm giving too long answers. I've never met a question I haven't had a long answer for, but that's a really long answer. But I've tried to take it really seriously. Have I dissuaded anyone else from answering?
It's like, did she question? Scare the rest of you
did
off?
Did I scare you? A quick question.
An easy one.
Yes.
You mentioned you encountered Beckett when you were 18. I assume that was in college.
Yes.
To what extent has what you studied in college stayed with you and influenced what you read and write?
I don't know who you are, but I love you for asking this question. Because, you know, as a writer and a humorist, I have sometimes felt constrained by the humorous label. In what I you know, there's a language in comedy, right?
And way too hard.
And I have sometimes felt a little bit like I wasn't going to write about certain things that are actually important to me. So in this book, I partially because I thought I might not be alive when it's published. It was a kind of a freedom for me. I went for it. Like I say in the book, I studied art history. I am not an expert. But I wanted to write about my relationship with art because it was something I returned to after this diagnosis, because it was something that had always helped me to see myself through paintings or through Hockney's work. Hockney's work became really important to me after this diagnosis, particularly there's one, his work in these later years, Pear Blossom Highway and Mulholland Drive, because those paintings, which are, and Pear Blossom Highway is a series of photographs which are influenced by Cubism, he's looking at his view of something from every single point of view. In Pear Blossom Highway, he's looking at this one stretch of highway
from every possible imaginable angle. And I felt this moment in my life called for a kind of detachment that I associate with cubism. And let me, again, one semester of art history, and I'm just going to say, a brief marriage to someone who did a master's program and is a painter at the Art Institute of Chicago. So, local connection. But I wanted to write about that, and I felt like this book was a return for me. In college, I studied avant-garde and experimental theater, which mostly meant we did versions of Greek plays set on a spaceship, set in medieval times. So I returned to Greek mythology. I returned to the plays that influenced me, like Beckett, because these are the things that really did interest me. So this book was a return. Uh-oh, we are getting the comedy hook, the version, the book festival version of a comedy hook. I'm going to be signing books. That's okay. First of all, I want to say thank you to Chelsea and to all of you here, and let's continue to talk. I'll be upstairs.
Yes.
Where will I be?
Thank you for that wonderful conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.